Hello, I am Zara Richter, and I am here with Shir Ali. We are here on the Facing Autonomy podcast. This is, I think, the 11th or 12th episode of the Facing Autonomy podcast. Today, we have an interesting discussion with renowned anarchist author Peter Gelderloos, whose most famous book is How Nonviolence Protects the State. But he has been working on some much newer projects that we look forward to hearing about in the next hour to hour and a half. Go ahead, Shir.
Yeah, I'd just like to give a quick shout out to some of the craziest activists who came out for J20 in Portland, California, and other states in the U.S. Currently in Pakistan, where I'm from, students have been confronting the police and the educational establishment and the fascist state over there, attempting to sort of struggle for their rights. And a lot of people got arrested last night. And I just want to give a quick shout out to them. I think today's episode will be, really interesting in the fact that it's going to talk a lot about strategy, tactics, and the current circumstances we're seeing around the world, and how to look at the current the return of the center in government in the U.S. as well. So hopefully through Peter's work we can sort of touch upon those topics and look at the current crackdown on anarchists and other groups. So Peter, you want to join in?
yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on.
All right. So, Peter, how long have you identified as an anarchist, and what does that mean to you? I want to start out with that question.
Yeah. I grew up in Virginia in the 80s and 90s. And so really until the Seattle riots of 1999, I didn't even realize that there was still an anarchist movement in the U.S. or really anywhere. So I immediately identified with it at that point. I guess that was my last year in high school. And I mean, before that, I, caused trouble in whatever ways I could, but, without knowing that, it was really possible for collective action or things like that. And since then, I've done what I could, getting involved in the places that I've lived, writing, publishing, and other things like that. So it's been a while.
Great. Would you say that your authorial work has your books that you've written, such as How Nonviolence Protects the State, has that come out of your experience, getting up, engaging in these subversive activities and discussions, or has it been independent research, or how did the nonviolence book come about?
Well, I'm not an academic. I don't have a university degree. I don't get paid for this. It came out of my experiences, out of my reading, out of conversations with other comrades, with people I respect. So before writing How Nonviolence Protects the State, I was particularly involved in the anti-war movement around the time of the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, counter-recruiting, ecological action, things like food, not bombs, and other stuff like that. Also, the tail end of these summit counter-mobilizations. And the first time I got assaulted in a protest was by peace police rather than the official police. I went to a North American Anarchist Convergence and was going to participate on a panel to debate a position critical of nonviolence, because they couldn't find anyone else, and the organizers of that panel had to. Basically just like prepared like really constrained format. And I'd done a lot of research. It was like my first panel. and, you know, I guess it was kind of precocious of me to volunteer, but I was just, you know, feeling quite like passionate and angry about all of these things that I had seen and experienced, things that I was reading, this very self-satisfied resistance to American wars that was, it was happy just to, you know, be on the streets and occupy a moral high ground without actually having any real impact on what was going on. So when I saw that the panel wouldn't happen, if they couldn't, you know, find anyone to speak in favor of violence as they were framing it, then I volunteered. But of course, with the exception that I wasn't speaking in favor of violence, as speaking in favor of the diversity of tactics, mm-hmm. and combative tactics and sabotage and you know, everything that's necessary and that's also compatible with, you know, with a more liberated world. Because as an anarchist, I don't separate ends and means. And they just shut the discussion down. They had like really superficial format that just restricted the whole conversation to cliches, and it was two against one. And anyways, that just got my goat. So I was gonna, you know, use the research that I had done for the panel and turn it into a pamphlet. But it just got longer and longer, and so it kind of, you know, I wrote a book by accident. And yeah, it was a combination of personal experiences and research that I had done and conversations with people whose perspectives I respect.
Yeah, what I really liked about that essay about nonviolence, and for me, you know, like I came across it, you know, like 5-6 years ago, just like scrolling anarchist library, was how accessible you had made the discussion around nonviolence, and you know, the way you sort of term it in sections, like how it's ineffective as a strategy tactic, but also that it's racist, statist, and it can be very patriarchal in that sense. And I really, you know, how did you sort of come to theorize or sort of frame it in that way would be my question.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I framed it in that way largely because that's sort of how I divided up for my research and for the preparation for this this debate panel. And then I found that it just worked really well as a very easy to explain way of presenting these critiques of nonviolence, and then just, you know, being really direct, which is something that I like to do, like just get to the heart of the problem, and you know, talk about what precisely is wrong with this dominant practice of nonviolence.
I do want to ask you about your later work, but before we get there, I want to ask you if you think this focus on nonviolence, which was present in the anti-war movement in the early 2000s, which I was also part of, do you think that focus on nonviolence is still going on in the American and global left, or do you think that your book is less prescient now than it was when it was written in 2007?
Obviously, it's a completely different context. Anyone who's had their eyes open has seen that direct action gets the good. They've seen that people who are speaking in favor of an exclusive nonviolence in this context are really just the first line of defense for the police, for the white supremacist state, for capitalism. And just you know, for anyone who hasn't read any of these critiques, I just want to make clear now, when I'm talking about nonviolence, I'm talking about an exclusive practice that tries to prevent or prohibit or marginalize any kind of participation in a social struggle that you know, they characterize as violent by widely shifting definitions. So that, it's not referring to people who in their personal participation in the struggle decide to focus on education or conflict resolution or care or gardening or whatever. It's about the people who are trying to exclude all other tactics besides the ones that they approve with the label of nonviolence. So yeah, obviously it's not the situation that it was in the early aughts when nonviolence was definitely hegemonic, even in a lot of the anarchist scene in North America. But at the same time, it's sort of an ever-present danger, if you will. After I'd been living in Barcelona for a little bit, some comrades here wanted to translate how nonviolence protects the state into Spanish. And at first I was like, don't do that. That's a waste of time. Why would you want to do that? Like, there's such a strong history here of a really combative, forceful movements that, you know, that use direct action, that self-organize, that have no respect for the law, you know, really strong anarchist history. But then the Plaza Occupation movement that started here in 2011 and was a direct precursor to the Occupy movement in the US, it became clear that you can actually have like a fully formed, huge, massive, nonviolent movement just drop from the sky in a sort of act of parthenogenesis. It can just come out of nowhere, but really it's coming from the media. It's coming from public education and how people are taught to view social change and civic responsibility and dissent and all the rest. So this huge movement just appeared out of nowhere, like it right on like the tail of like these like huge general strikes where like, you know, the city was just set on fire and you know, everything was blockaded and barricaded and smashed. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you had hundreds of thousands of people on the one hand participating in assemblies, which led to a lot of interesting possibilities that, you know, that could move in a radical direction or not, depending on how we engage with them. But also people who were all of a sudden insisting that, you know, you had to be nonviolent because that's the only way that anything was ever going to change. And it's like, where did you come from? Like, how do you believe like it in a country that has like such a strong movement of labor struggles that continues up to the present day? Like, everyone should know that the only reason people have, you know, vacation time or 8-hour days or healthcare or, you know, any of those things to the extent that they do have them is because people were practicing sabotage and they were carrying out wildcat strikes and really heavy general strikes and really just throwing down. And one of the reasons why, you know, so many of those protections have been eroded has been because that labor movement has been institutionalized and it's no longer engaging in these autonomous and combative and frequently illegal actions. So that was just really surprising, but it reminded me that, you know, they like nonviolence can just be summoned out of thin air. And so it's really helpful. I think movements are stronger when they're more conscious of those patterns and those dangers. And so I think people in the state saw that this past year with how nonviolent discourses were sort of brought in the back door, you know, around these discourses of outside infiltrators and all the rest. And that's something that I've like since writing the two books on nonviolence, I've tried to focus attention towards with this WordPress website, violentanarchist.wordpress.com, like bringing together all these examples internationally, just how systematically it's used. This trope of, you know, professional provocateurs who are the ones who are actually responsible for, you know, property destruction and looting in these riots. And it was really a short step from first, like the media, the corporate media realizing, you know, that, you know, okay, they're getting overwhelmed by just the force and the massive support for these uprisings. And so saying like, okay, well, we can sympathize with them burning down, you know, one police precinct, but, you know, we need to look for solutions. And for, you know, a few weeks, they had everyone believing that, you know, there was actually going to be police abolition in the US. And then from there, they said, well, actually, maybe the you know, the violence was caused by provocateurs. Maybe they were even white supremacists. And, you know, then you can also get, you know, reformist organizations that, you know, cover themselves in a veneer of racial justice, but are more interested in sort of managing these struggles or, you know, pacifying them or, you know, just giving people an America that they can believe in for whatever reason. You know, they gave a lot of support and backing to those discourses. And then from there, you know, now that like, you know, half a year has passed since most of those have quieted down, you know, people are the same people who were, you know, saying, okay, well, you know, it looks like, you know, burning down that police precinct was actually a pretty popular thing. Now they're, you know, they've completely rewritten the history of it. To say that, you know, this was a mostly nonviolent movement and the nonviolence was good, but the violence was bad. And that's why we need these new anti-extremist laws to punish white supremacists and other extremists. And of course, that and other that's coming for the anti-racist, that's coming for the anarchist, that's coming for, you know, for all of us. And that's how it happens. That's why people today think that the movement against colonialism in India was nonviolent, when it wasn't. It was, it had nonviolent instances, but it wasn't a nonviolent movement. That's why people today think that the anti-segregation movement, the civil rights movement in the United States was nonviolent. It wasn't. It had nonviolent instances, but it's happening now in real time, and it's up to us whether or not we learn those same lessons. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, it was rough, you know, coming up as an anarchist in the U.S. in the 90s. The U.S. is a country that has really powerful histories of rebellion and revolt. But history is a living thing, and if we're not sharing it, if we're not keeping it alive in the streets, then we lose it. And so, you know, not having access to our histories of resistance makes our struggle so much weaker. And so everything that was gained by all those people taking over the streets in cities across the U.S. and in other countries throughout 2000, all that strength will be lost if we don't take charge of not even, I'm going to say, writing our own history, because history shouldn't just be written. It should be kept alive, you know, in our mouths, passed on by word of mouth. So if we don't make the history and keep that history alive, then the same opportunists are gonna do the same thing. So, you know, there's patterns there, and so for that reason, I think the topic of nonviolence is still relevant.
You know, on the ground, we saw after Occupy and later in the BLM movements, how the role of pacifists and you know, especially in the democratic socialist circles, especially the ICE abolition protests, like how, you know, there were, you know, allegations of them working alongside the police or compromising with the police. And I think the type of the manner in which police tactics have changed, you know, I think like this is a very, very poignant article in that sense. Yeah. And I think it's also, you know, there's a sort of stream which goes throughout your work, you know, and when you're writing, there's sort of this sort of stream, you know, of, you know, how it relates to the other article, Diagnostics of Future. I think we should get into that article as well a little bit. So, yeah, Zahra, you want to lead that off?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to move the conversation forward to Peter's most recent work, but you need to speak up a little bit louder, more consistently. Sure, you're definitely mumbling.
Yeah.
But to get back to our content here, how has your work evolved, Peter, since the books about nonviolence? I read your short essay, Diagnostic of the Future, this past week in preparation for this interview. And it seems a lot more like, it feels like that book is more like an anarchist kind of taking stock of current events, instead of, it feels a lot less focused on a specific tactical problem, if you will. It feels like a more general analysis of perhaps what people on a different part of the left would call like the political economy of today's situation. What was the inspiration for Diagnostics of the Future?
So yeah, like you said, I mean, there's been like something of an evolution, or rather just focus. I guess I try to focus on things that seem relevant to me, both within immediate short term struggles and also maybe weaknesses that come up again and again. So for example, with anarchy works, you know, trying to come up with something like with a lot of examples of anarchy in practice in one place to make it easier for people to respond to all these questions, because a lot of times, you know, anarchist methods become really popular in a struggle because they're effective, because they're empowering for people, and people connect with those and you know, take them for their own, but then won't really link them to a longer term transformation because they're you know, because they, you know, they're trained to believe that anarchy is impractical in any you know, larger scale or anything like that. So with Diagnostic of the Future, the need or the shortcoming that I was coming up in contact with was a kind of on the one hand, an awareness that that capitalism was in crisis, democracy was in crisis, the whole planet, and you know, like our system of living globally is in crisis, but not a lot of clarity about how those crises would manifest, and how we should get ahead of the curve, how we should develop strategies that anticipate changes that are coming down the line. And in a lot of past revolutions, you've actually seen you've seen radicals, anarchists, and others kind of, you know, get on a wagon that's rebelling against the kind of authority that's already becoming obsolete. So, for example, when the grip of the church on, you know, on the hearts and minds, on all of society was already weakened, had already in a lot of ways become overthrown, a lot of anarchists, talking now about, you know, like 19th century anarchists, were really vociferously supporting the scientific world visions and mythologies that were the backbone of the institutions that would, you know, really be definitive of state power throughout the 20th century. So, you know, like the criticisms of you know, of the church were valid, but it would have helped to also develop criticisms of ways that scientific practices and worldviews can completely, you know, be bent to the service of oppression, of the state, of capitalism, and all the rest. And you know, it would be a tragedy if we did the same thing again. And you know, you can see that, like, specifically in the environmentalist movement, which is really laying out the red carpet for green capitalism, which I think is going to be like a really key way for the state to deal with these crises. Like there's certain possibilities offered by green capitalism, where if you take like the intersection of these different crises, the crisis of legitimacy of government, the crisis of accumulation of capitalism, and then the ecological crisis, that you can actually find a synthesis that solves all of those crises from the standpoint of power, from the standpoint of oppression. And yeah, like green capitalism is really useful to that. So these kind of consumer politics, or, you know, this very narrow focus on carbon emissions, on climate change, is really setting us up for another big failure. And so I guess, since I didn't see a lot of, like, a lot of the people who do like more global analyses of the moment, or like, you know, political economy, like you mentioned, you know, they put a lot of good work into it, and some of them, I think, create analyses that are very useful in some ways, but also a lot of them tend towards a very economist sort of materialist disempowering approach, which I think in the end is a bit more useful to capital than to any of us, because it doesn't really look at strategies of resistance. It doesn't really look at how we also create the world, and we can, you know, we can create the crises that we want to, you know, that we want to see, and the solutions that we want to see.
Yeah, no, this is amazing. I was kind of also interested in the section, you know, from the article, you know, on democratic renewal, where you speak about how an anti-fascist democrat is just a variation on the counter-revolutionary model that democratic movements have used since the beginning of modernity. And you lay out like several key characteristics of that. Could you elaborate on that, and just like sort of how that impacts, you know, how we look at the world? And another theme, which I think is also in the article, is, you know, we shouldn't be looking from the perspective of the capitalist, but rather, you know, how we inhabit the world, the potentiality of, you know, what is possible, right?
So I mean, the democratic renewal, we're living it right now. We're staring at it in the face, and that for me is another great example of why it's necessary to like together develop calm, clear-headed analyses of what historical situation are we actually facing. Because so many people throughout the years of Trump were saying, oh my God, we're on the cusp of a fascist coup, a fascist takeover. We're going to be living in under a fascist dictatorship? And no, like any analysis of how fascism has actually functioned historically, any analysis of the relationship between fascism and democracy and fascism and capitalism shows that capitalists don't need fascism right now. It wouldn't help them out. They need it as a street movement. They need it, you know, attacking immigrants, attacking radicals, and you know, killing people and shifting discourses. But they don't need a dictatorship actually holding power in a really major, powerful country like, you know, like the U.S. And so that, I think that led to a whole lot of fear, a whole lot of paranoia, and definitely a lot of bad analysis, and people not being prepared for what the greater midterm danger was, which was a democratic renewal in which, I mean, you know, who did like the bleeding and the dying and all the like the you know, the grunt work and just all of the organizing to keep fascists at bay? It was radical anti-capitalist, anti-racists, you know, a huge portion of the anarchists. And you know, now that, you know, like the left and the center are back in power, you know, that's, you know, who's also going to be facing the repression. And sometimes it was like discursively it was done really well. Sometimes it was done in a way that always pointed back towards anti-capitalism, that always pointed back towards revolution. But many times it was done in a way that actually reinforced democratic values, like, you know, oh, you know, we need better judges, we need you know, we need the police to be more fair, and, you know, also go after the fascists and not just go after us. Or, you know, we need to be just, I mean, you know, I mean, there was a lot of discourse about that, you know, that, like, you know, centered these ideas of like democratic fairness, and, you know, we need like to have, like, you know, to protect our democracy and so on and so forth. So there's a historical critique of anti-fascism, but I want to make it very clear that it's not like, I, like, you know, if I had been living in the States in 2016 and my opinion actually mattered in that regard, and since I wasn't, it doesn't, you know, I would have argued against using the anti-fascist label. And, you know, talking with friends, you know, I also did make those arguments. But, like, that's you know, really less important. The most important thing is, like, how do we confront fascism? Do we do it in a way that, you know, that brings us back to anarchy and anti-capitalism revolution, or do we do it in a way that empowers democracy? And you know, there are a lot of great examples of that. And above all, there was just really amazing, vital, and really courageous work doing research on the fascists, always showing up, not giving them a platform, shutting them down. And that was hugely essential, and that's part of the reason why the fascists are so disorganized today in the States. So I just want to make clear, you know, going in, that, like, this criticism is not at all against that work. It's a historical criticism of anti-fascism as a unified front, right? So this popular front anti-fascism can actually be traced back to the failure of communist party strategies against the fascists in Germany in the 1920s and 30s, where actually they wanted to destroy their opponents on the left. They wanted to destroy the socialists, for example, and prioritize that over fighting the fascists, fighting the Nazis, and at times even tacitly teamed up with the Nazis to fight the socialists and social democrats, and that, you know, backfired. And so once the Nazis you know, were about to sweep power, then they started this popular front anti-fascism. But again, a large part of their goal was actually to neutralize Trotskyists, to neutralize council communists, to neutralize anarchists, and you know, whoever wasn't loyal to the party, and, you know, like, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Like, that was actually their strategy. A lot of the Popular Front was about control. So the struggle against fascism in Spain, the Spanish Civil War, one of the more stronger examples of, you know, a partial anarchist revolution, at least in practice, it's very possible that at that point, you know, they were just doomed, that, you know, they were surrounded on all sides. So it's very possible that they might not have been able to win anyways. But in the actual history as it occurred, the revolution in Spain wasn't defeated by the fascists outside of a few areas at the very, very beginning of the conflict, like Andalusia. It was defeated by the communists. It was defeated by anti-fascism, by this common front, in which, you know, people claimed the bigger danger is fascism, And so we need to rally together against that. And in the meantime, you know, y'all irresponsible anarchists, you have to put off your revolution. And under cover of that alliance, the Stalinists and also other left-wing parties suppressed all of these revolutionary experiences, the collectives and so on and so forth. And there's examples of that happening again and again and again up to the present moment.
Yeah. And well, I think like being from Pakistan and, you know, especially South Asia, like, you know, I see this, you know, whenever an authoritarian regime comes to power or some sort of, you know, dictatorship or, you know, there's a tendency to always move back towards the popular front, you know, strategy or tactic. And I wonder what is, you know, the reason, you know, for that. Is it the class composition of these movements? You know, is it, you know, the lack of rootedness and like sort of, you know, lack of organizing or strategic sort of element to it? Or, you know, there's something about, you know, how there's always a return back to like either a democratic socialist or like a popular front sort of formula. And it's always like a negation of the actual movements, you know, the people who are putting their bodies, you know, lives on the line, you know, struggling, you know, for example, the abolition movement here or what we were seeing over the last year in the U.S., especially. What is why do you think this like popular front or united left tactic always sort of reemerges? And, you know, thinking about it, like, you know, one of the negative elements of it is this idea that, you know, from a top-down perspective, you can sort of co-opt movements or sort of co-opt things that are happening within society at a larger level, you know, for some popular gain or some other interest.
I think it keeps happening because the left systematically proposes those strategies, because they're looking at strategy from the standpoint of what increases the power, what improves the position of their organization, their party. And so when, you know, when the right is in power, that's it's going to make sense to, you know, gather allies around you who will, you know, act as buffers against the state, who you can, you know, potentially exploit, so on and so forth. And if radicals don't specifically counter it, then you know, that's how it's going to go down time and time and time again. And we have problems countering it because, I mean, first of all, Western society trains us to trust in binaries. So in this socio-historical cultural context, like, people who are arguing in terms of binaries have a little bit of an advantage, you know, the good and the bad, the left and the right. So the left is clearly better than the right, so we have to support the left against the right. We need to have more engagement with history for people to understand, like, okay, we're not actually being sectarian, we're not actually being dogmatic, but like, it, you know, entering into this alliance in an uncritical way is actually dangerous for us. It's actually not a good idea. We need to be in touch with our own history in order to get that idea across. And meanwhile, the people on the other side are, you know, they have this convenient binary to make their pseudo arguments. And finally, that's something that's not going to be possible if people are making strategic analysis on the basis of panic or on the basis of you know, feeling the urgency of the situation, mm-hmm. rather than sticking to the decision that they made when they were calm. And like, I mean, I just mentioned Spain, like that's, you know, a great tragedy. Like in May of 1936, the CNT, the Anarchist Labor Confederation, got together. They knew that a fascist coup was, you know, was in the works, because there's, you know, actually evidence of those things. They can't go down okay. without extensive planning. And they decided, okay, this is the time to make the revolution. We're going to make the revolution and declare anarchist communism, abolish money, take it over, organize it all ourselves. And so in this moment of like calm and reflection with, you know, delegates from all over the country coming together and debating, that's the decision they made. But just 2 months later, when the fascist coup happened, and they're all of a sudden facing the urgency of the moment, they went back on that and decided, okay, first we win the war, then we make the revolution, and they shot themselves in the foot. And to a lesser extent, I think there's that's been going on in You know, I mean, like it happened in Greece with Syriza, when Syriza came into power, and, you know, a lot of anarchists decided, or other anti-capitalists decided, to support the referendum. It's, you know, it happened in, you know, with like the pink wave in South America, and, you know, to a certain extent in the U.S. with, like, you know, okay, like, you know, with being less prepared for like this kind of democratic renewal.
And I think, like, there's another element, you know, this, like, you know, always, you know, this idea that you can align with liberals or neoliberals and essentially do a politics within the Democratic Party. And it's also the class reductionism, right? You know, not considering what is racist, you know, the systematic sort of nature of racism or, you know, transphobia or, like, other forms of marginalization in society, which are, you know, there are other material processes aside from, like, meta sort of economic sort of ways of looking at, you know, sort of class struggle or those things. And I think, you know, it's a very dangerous trend because, you know, it doesn't put the question of alternatives or creating an alternative social world or revolution, social war at the forefront, or cultural revolution at the forefront, or those things. So, yeah, I really agree with what you're saying in all of this. I also felt that, you know, in diagnostics of the future, you know, you're sort of in the conclusion, as you're just mentioning, you know, you're asking anarchists to sort of think of things strategically. Could you, like, elaborate about that, like, in the concluding, you know, section? You know, I think it was I have the article in front of me, and the anarchist ? Where you're also talking about what is the sort of primary sort of paradox that we have to get out of to develop or spread revolutionary imaginaries or communalize sort of daily life or those things.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, part of strategizing is just, like, understanding what our enemies are doing and what they're going to do, what their needs are. And a lot of that, I mean, it takes work, but it's fairly easy to find out just, you know, by, like, looking at what are they saying at the World Economic Forum? What are they saying at NATO summits? You know, how do they identify dangers? How do they identify, you know, opportunities for them going forward? And so kind of understanding, you know, like, where the next shots are going to be coming from. But then as far as anarchist strategizing, like, that's particular because we're not, you know, we're not the generals of an army. Like, for us, strategy has to be a paradigmatically different activity because we don't have one master plan that we can institute. And if we try to do that, then we're just going to be fighting each other as we have to, you know, denounce the comrades who aren't realizing that our plan is the best plan and, you know, the most intelligent one. So, like, in a, like it says in 23 Theses Concerning Revolt, anarchist strategy is deciding at every moment how to act within, you know, this chaotic network of relationships, within the possibilities and with the resources that we have at hand. So not deciding how other people should act, but really deciding how to interact, how to create complementarities, how to create synergies with what other people are doing, and sure, try to influence other people's strategies, but, you know, not. Never assuming that, you know, we can have, you know, the strategy for the movement, but so trying to move within those networks strategically. And that's also interesting because that, you know, that gives us an advantage that serves as a counterweight to the fact that the state just, you know, completely outguns us and completely overwhelms us when it comes to resources. We can generate this opacity or this illegibility. We can move intelligently in chaos in a way that states never can. States have to flatten reality in order to be able to minimally understand it and intervene in it. And so we can take advantage of collective intelligence in a way that they can't. And we can move in reality as it actually exists without having to flatten it. But of course, that does require a bit of a break with the sort of Western ways of thinking that are a fundamental part of colonialism, as going back 500 years and to the present moment, so that's also like a part of whiteness today, is like conditioning people to think in that way, looking down at our lives from above. So in regarding strategy in diagnostic, like I was definitely a bit pessimistic, just because like over the last 15 years or so, we've been able to defeat the state numerous times in specific contests, in the streets, in riots. We've been able to create ungovernability that the state really just has to kind of like back off and wait out. So that tactical consideration isn't the big limiting factor. People like experience can be lost if we don't preserve it. So it's important that we always, maintain that experience of how to take over the streets. But there's these questions of sustaining ourselves in struggle. There's these questions of dealing with the cyclicity, like the cycles of struggle, how things, they're always going to be doldrums. They're always going to be lulls after moments of extreme intensity. And if we're just expecting like this mechanical output or this constant geometric expansion of struggle, then we're going to be disappointed. We're going to burn out. And particularly with burnout, with internal conflicts, with power dynamics, we're not really good at those. For the most part, we don't have real communities. We still view survival, if we're even thinking about survival, and that's another problem. People who are, I think like have never really had to think about their own survival. Often, having a sort of exaggerated influence or power within our circles, and sort of that influencing like our discourses and our priorities, but still often thinking about survival in an individualistic sense rather than collectivizing survival. And so I think if we can't not just fight in the streets as anarchists, which is a beautiful thing, it's beautiful when that goes well, but also take care of one another as anarchists. Anti-capitalist, I don't really care about the labels. And communalize our weaknesses, communalize our suffering, support one another. Then we're just gonna, keep having these like flashes in the pan and then long acrimonious periods of burnout and conflict. And also there's other things we're good at. We've gotten really good at facing repression in a lot of countries over the last couple decades, such that the same kind of repressive campaigns that governments were doing 10 years ago, they're just not working anymore, because we know how to support one another, do jail support, get legal support, hold it together, like push back against state attempts to isolate us. But still there's a part of that that I think largely gets neglected, both like power dynamics that can arise in those situations and don't get questioned, and then like the emotional support that's often lacking, because you can still be a revolutionary in prison. So if we're going to be honest, like the worst thing about repression isn't the objective fact of someone is in prison, or even dead. We've lost a lot of comrades, we've lost a lot of loved ones in the last year. But if we do it right, they can still be there for us, a part of their lives. They can still be a source of strength for us. Or they can be like a big gaping hole in the trauma that makes us just not want to continue. So that's really the critical question. Don't stop on the legal support. Don't stop on like the jail support and all the rest. That's crucial. But I'd say it's actually not the most important part of dealing with it, because whether we can continue to live and fight as revolutionaries depends a lot on how we roll with those blows, rather than if we can post bail or not.
Mm-hmm. Zara, you have any questions?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm seeing what you're talking about, Peter, is playing out in a funny way, as far as there's a split in the current left, and especially among anarchists, between tactics which are more centered on mutual aid and tactics which are more centered on building like organizations or institutions. And so I'm seeing a lot of people who are formerly part of the IWW with me, which is an organization that I do work with. A bunch of them are joining like locally based mutual aid groups, you know, and I don't think that that's a negative thing, but I also think that mutual aid as a goal on its own, it might originate in, say, Peter Kropotkin. Of course, that concept comes from Peter Kropotkin, but it's very easily taken on by kind of a liberal nonprofit industrial complex kind of approach, right? And I do notice a very huge difference between kind of the Occupy Hurricane Sandy efforts, which came out post-Occupy, where the Occupy movement was going out and helping people from the dealing with the hurricane that had hit the same area, you know, parts of New York City, to the mutual aid movement, which is going on right now, which is the mutual aid movement that's going on right now is very disconnected from the organized anarchist kind of left, if you will. So, what, Peter, do you have any, how do you feel about this kind of separation or this kind of break, which we're seeing from anarchists that are more focused on organization and anarchists that are more focused on mutual aid?
I don't think, I mean, I won't comment specifically on the US, but I've seen similar things play out elsewhere. I don't think it's a very useful division to make. And so I would hope that people could find ways to kind of circumvent that dichotomy between mutual aid initiatives and organization. I think that mutual aid, if it's done as actual mutual aid and not as charity with a new cool name, is fundamentally subversive, but also, you know, it can be co-opted, but anything can be co-opted. Organizations can also definitely be co-opted. I think people need to, you know, to pick the methods and the tactics that are most adequate for the moment. I think that over here we've had a problem of a lot of people, you know, in when there's not a lot of activity that they feel like that they can get behind or like what they're specifically interested in, they create organizations thinking that, you know, organizations generate struggle, which I think is a flawed way of looking at it. I think organizations modulate struggle. They can focus our activity, but I think it's a question of like in the intensity of the struggle, the density of the struggle. And I think, you know, more organization becomes useful, the more, you know, the more like dense and intense a movement is, the more activity there is. But if people turn to organization in these moments when, you know, when they feel like there's more inactivity, then I think they're going to end up just spending a lot of time, you know, in this constant existential crisis of, you know, okay, well, how does this organization define itself and what's its purpose and, you know, how can it, you know, summon the masses? Whereas mutual aid, like if people are not going to be thinking about it as a way to transform how they live permanently, if people are just going to take it as a handout, then it's going to have, you know, much less subversive potential. And part of that comes down to like the social context of, you know, like what are people actually looking for? And part of it comes down to how do we frame it? How do we offer it? How do we organize it? But yeah, like if it's, so it shouldn't be contractual. Like we shouldn't create a mutual aid project thinking like, okay, we're going to be, sharing food, but if, you know, people who are getting food aren't immediately giving something back to make it mutual, then we don't want anything to do with them. Like, you know, there has to be patience. It takes time. But if we're not thinking about how are we going to like break these dynamics of charity, how are we going to make this mutual aid an invitation to complicity, an invitation to creating like networks of you know, mutual support between people, then, you know, then it will probably in our society inevitably just kind of devolve into charity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
definitely.
No, that's really well said. So just talking about, you know, the current political situation in the U.S. and sort of what's taking place after the George Floyd rebellion and those things, like, what do you think are the key lessons we can learn and how can we build upon that? And I also have some questions about your work around ecology, anarchist ecology. I think that's good. Maybe we could do the anarchist ecology one first and then conclude with the latter point. But, you know, Zara, Do you think that's cool?
That sounds great. Yeah, I do want to hear about Peter's new work about anti-colonialism and ecology. I heard from Shear that, Peter, you're working on a new book on anarchism and anti-colonialism and ecology. So I'd love to hear about that, too, for sure.
Great. I might actually pass on the question about the George Floyd revolts. I mean, I've been in the States in earlier waves of anti-police rebellions, but, you know, of course, with the pandemic and everything, you know, I haven't been there for all of 2000. So, I mean, like, I saw my place as, like, you know, trying to offer some support from a distance, like, trying to, like, help counter, like, all this agent provocateur BS that was going around on the internet. And then, you know, trying to spread news about the revolt to other places, trying to, like, in the movement here, emphasize the importance of anti-racism and all the rest. But for me, it was, you know, entirely, like, going the other way around, where I was, you know, I've been learning a lot from everything that's coming out of the States. So I don't think I should be the one to really speak about lessons learned. But I'd be happy to talk about the next book.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
That's great.
Yeah, okay. Great. Right. So it doesn't have a title yet, but it'll be coming out with Pluto Press. It looks at the ecological crisis beyond the reductionism of climate change, which of course is extremely important, but it's a very technocratic approach to separate climate change and carbon emissions from all other aspects of the ecological crisis, which include mass extinctions, habitat loss, soil erosion, desertification, starvation, migration, the violence of borders, ongoing colonialism, repression against indigenous land reclamation actions and campaigns. The absolute precarity of poor people in urban environments who are forced to live in a urbanization that doesn't, you know, that constructs nature as something that has no place in the cities and you know, has these cities that are just basically focal points for various kinds of pollution and exploitation. Anyways, it's the point that I'm trying to make is that it doesn't make any sense to separate ideas of nature from, you know, like human problems and human issues. The ecological crisis absolutely has a human dimension, or rather, like, all of it is in flux. Like, you can't, I don't even think it makes sense to look at it in different dimensions, but all of it is inflected with questions that we humans are grappling with. And it also doesn't make sense to blame climate change or the ecological crisis on humans the way that, you know, this terminology of the Anthropocene does, like, you know, trying to name the current geological era as you know, the one defined by, you know, the harmful impacts of humankind, which is really, you know, just completely, like, insulting BS, because all these institutions of power that have, you know, only recognized one kind of humanity for centuries, you know, for like a lot of indigenous peoples, for example, it will be the first time that they're recognized as fully human by a lot of these institutions of power, you know, right the moment when, you know, they're trying to decide, like, how to assign the blame for climate change and ecological collapse. Well, let's blame humanity after we have forced this destructive capitalist system, you know, down the throats of the entire world and you know, just actively erased many, many other ways of being human that are based on a mutual healthy relationship with the rest of the natural world. So basically it's an attempt to bring an anti-colonial gaze to the ecological crisis and to thoughts about resistance to the ecological crisis. So instead of, say, like Extinction Rebellion coming along and making no reference to all of the really powerful struggles in defense of the earth that have happened these last decades, you know, they come in and try to get governments to declare a climate emergency through nonviolent civil disobedience, not talking about indigenous encampments that have stopped pipelines, not talking about autonomous zones that have blocked airports, not talking about, you know, just like fierce resistance in the Niger Delta against oil exploitation there, not talking about, people from Russia to Brazil stopping deforestation. So that's problematic. So a lot of the book will focus on the kinds of struggle that have already been going on and that actually empower territories, empower people to connect with not just, the earth as an abstract, but with the actual land that they live on, to create relationships with it, to defend it, and to stop this capitalist death machine.
Yeah.
Right. So, is your work on this, is it reacting? I know a piece of writing which has a lot of pull on the anarchist left around ecology issues right now is the essay Desert. Are you influenced by Desert, or do you reject its influence? Do you think total environmental catastrophe is something that we can even avoid in the next 10 or 20 years, or do you think that total environmental catastrophe is something that is just inevitable, and when we have to get ready for, a desertified, flooded, environmental, more or less apocalypse within our lifetimes?
I think total environmental catastrophe is already here, but as long as capitalism continues to function, it will allow a certain number of us to maintain relatively comfortable lives from surplus violently extracted from. On a planetary scale. I'm very glad that Desert was written. I think it was a very useful exercise, and there are certain agreements, there are certain arguments in Desert that I very much agree with. Other framings that I don't agree with so much, they sort of present like a kind of patchwork vision of the future, and I think state power and capitalism are so integrated at a global scale that that they won't, I don't think they'll surrender areas of the globe the way that are envisioned in Desert. I mean, you can have sacrifice zones without those zones escaping the clutches of state intervention. And so I do think that the way that the state and capitalism are constructed, it seems like an iron fortress until the moment that the resistance is just too much. And then I think it all falls like a house of cards. But I mean, they are, undeniably highly integrated at a global level. So I don't. Just to name one thing, that's one thing that I don't see as much from Desert. But it was definitely. It was definitely useful for a lot of people to read to imagine things like that. So it was good. A good text to memorize.
I think I had one question, about the relationship between fascism and the ecological crisis or the climate crisis currently taking place. What would your sort of take be on that? How have you seen the intensification of the crisis? We're seeing in the Amazon under Bolsonaro or other places across the globe, sort of a viciousness in the way state fascist states or authoritarian states are sort of approaching the climate thing. And then on a separate level, there's calls for a Green New Deal or something like that. How do you look at that sort of and how can we make that central to our organizing practices or our strategic discussions?
Really, the best thing that's been written on fascism in this present moment, one of the more recent texts, is The Unquiet Dead, Anarchism, Fascism, and Mythology. And that pays a lot of attention to the danger of ecofascism, the danger of fascist tendencies within environmental movements, and I think kind of defines that problem, at least in terms of shared mythologies and shared influences. What we're seeing is in practice right now is a little bit less full-on fascist dictatorships, but certainly political movements that flirt with fascist ideas, making alliances with mainstream environmentalists. There's a very recent example from Austria the right-wing government of the Austrian chancellor, in order to be in power, made a coalition with like actual like an actual neo-Nazi party, and so that, you know, eventually the neo-Nazi party had to leave the government because of a scandal. But I mention this to give you an indication of how far right the main party, the Folks Party, is in Austria, that they were willing to be in a coalition government with neo-Nazis. Afterwards, to make a new coalition, because they're, you know, they're a minority, their next coalition partners were the Green Party of Austria. So that's, I mean, it's a very real thing. You know, it goes beyond just like, you know, more like Nazi recruiting in, you know, in animal rights circles. It's like, it's an actual equation for government nowadays. And I would say that that's an inevitable outgrowth of this limited single issue technocratic focus on the environment, like pretending that we can view the ecological crisis as, you know, just a question of carbon emissions, just a question of climate, and not everything altogether, including very human concerns of borders, migration, colonialism, and indigenous struggles. When you strip all of that away from the ecological crisis, all of these very human questions, what you're left with is the good conscience and the comfort of privileged citizens, like you know, like white Europeans or white people in North America, you know, who want to protect pandas. They want to, you know, send some money to keep, you know, barbaric poor people from poaching the poor animals and you know, make sure that there are nature reserves. I mean, the World Wildlife Fund, the WWF, the panda NGO, they actually pay for paramilitaries that have been engaged in murders and genocidal acts against indigenous people in Africa. I mean, the whole idea of a nature preserve, of mainstream idea of conservationism, is a completely aristocratic colonial idea that's connected to very racist practices. So, you know, I mean, if they're doing it in Africa, you know, they're eventually going to start doing it in Europe too. And so that's inevitable, an inevitable aspect of the technocratic approach or the single issue approach to environmentalism, is that it will tend towards some, at least something similar to something that shares a lot of traits with eco-fascism. And then there's also, and that in fact connects to, if we go from eco-fascism to eco-totalitarianism, to like expand the scope of, you know, what kind of you know, authoritarianism are we looking at? A lot of the official state response to climate change and the ecological crisis has to do with mapping, and it has to do with monetizing all biological relationships, monetizing the value of every single species, the value of every single biological process on this planet. It's an industry now, ecosystem services. So, you know, this is going beyond natural resources to full-on mapping. And this would be a precursor to remaking the entire planet as a technocratically managed factory, with, you know, a few nature reserves for rich people to, you know, go on eco-tourist vacations with, and to, you know, nominally preserve species that are, you know, considered more economically viable. And that ties into a lot of the surveillance technologies that are really being rolled out and expanded in these years. So that mainstream environmentalism is also connected to the kind of totalitarianism that is, I think, more of a present danger and more of a reality than fascism on the governmental level. The Green New Deal supports that, even though it's coming from the left. It provides the funding for that. It's a great answer for capitalism. Capitalism is in a crisis of accumulation. Profitability is going down around the world. You know, China is one of the few countries that has managed to maintain its economic growth. It did that in large part by encouraging really massive iron mining, iron exploitation in Australia, destroying a large number of indigenous sacred sites there. But it's also based in large part on a ballooning public debt in China. So capitalism needs to open up a new frontier. And you know, the entire world is covered. So the new frontier kind of goes up and goes down simultaneously to planetary and nano scales. managing the very climatic and biological processes of the planet. And a first step in that is an energy transition toward, you know, towards renewable energy, which are extremely destructive when they're deployed on an industrial scale. If you take, you know, our huge energy needs that we have, there's no ecologically healthy way to meet those energy needs. So the kind of energy that needs to be developed, if you're using wind farms, then we're talking about huge land grabs that are already happening, especially in, you know, more marginalized communities, largely in the global south, for example. The mining that needs to happen for solar cells, for batteries. I mean, there's a huge amount of devastation that's going on right now for the green transition in energy. And like what capitalism needs is a sort of Keynesianism where governments pour their massive resources, these resources that, you know, that really don't have a comparison, into a new direction for capitalist accumulation, which is like an industrial expansion through green energies and then these other interventions.
I feel another thing that, you know, especially about this part that you're talking about, you know, is the global culture of consumption, right? And the creation of waste and all those things. I think, like, you know, on the ground, like, you know, mutual aid, like having an alternative social project or something is going to be really key. And also, like, building alliances, right? Not just because it's also a global scale issue, right? What would your take be on that, I guess, you know, at a certain level, like the sort of mass consumerism, mass consumption society, like everything we buy, everything, you know, how we live, it requires, you know, sort of a different sort of creativity, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it would help to really insist more vocally that, you know, that capitalist society or Western civilization or whatever you want to call it is a failed civilization. It's you know, the first one in the history of the world to bring about the possibility of planetary collapse. And so we can't, you know, trot out some solution that pretends to keep pretty much everything the same, but just make a few small technical changes. You know, everything down to the way we view life and the way we view happiness needs to change. I mean, at least I'm speaking from the perspective of, like, you know, like, you know, someone whose culture is capitalism, because, you know, of course there are many, many communities, many societies that exist that are still fighting for very effective technologies and effective cultures that are based on sustainable, reciprocal, healthy, respectful relations among living beings. And, you know, so they're, you know, like, they're the ones who should be talking most about what the solution is and, you know, who other people should be learning from, rather than, you know, thinking, oh yeah, we can just preserve consumerism and we can preserve supermarkets and, you know, Amazon and, like, you know, online purchases and, you know, front door delivery and all the rest. But, you know, we'll just get a different energy source for it. Like, we need to be, you know, like those of us who have no culture outside of capitalist coloniality need to be looking you know, in completely new directions. And so, yeah, we need internationalist and not alliances. We need solidarity between different struggles. A lot of really inspiring struggles are linking how they survive with how they fight back against destructive mega projects with how they defend the land. And, you know, that can be anything from an urban garden where we're resisting capitalist urbanism, where, you know, like all space is dedicated to the accumulation of profit. So taking over space, cleaning it up, you know, bringing back something resembling soil and, you know, creating also an ecosystem for more species and something that we can get food out of and we can start to sustain ourselves out of. To things like what a lot of Mapuche communities are doing, where they're actually, you know, sabotaging and in a lot of cases cutting down these forestry plantations of like homogeneous genetically modified pine and eucalyptus, which incidentally enter into the mainstream environmentalist technocratic solution to climate change. Because even though these are not real forests, they're monoculture tree plantations that are very destructive to the environment, they're counted as carbon sinks in the paperwork. And so a country like Chile, which you know, they've covered so much of their indigenous territory with these forestry plantations, they can claim to, you know, be like these leaders in the fight against climate change, because, you know, all of these supposed carbon sinks they have, which are really just plantations that exist for the logging industry, which, you know, can paint itself green. So a lot of Mapuche communities are chopping down these plantations in order to recover land for their own subsistence agriculture, to feed themselves, to strengthen their autonomy so they don't have to be dependent on the market for their own food, and also recovering native tree species, which were largely chopped down in earlier waves of colonization. So these things that bring together, you know, defending the land, healing the land, and linking our own survival up with the land, those are, I think, some of the most empowering, potent things that we can be doing. And they're relevant, they're possible from the middle of the city to the high mountains. And they're also, they become stronger and more intelligent when they link up. We have different empowered territories, creating direct relationships with one another without intermediaries, learning from one another, sharing resources and lessons, and offering one another support and solidarity.
I want to ask you about a continuing internal debate to the anarchist world, which is the discussion which continued to pop up, at least online, between anarcho-primitivists and more class struggle oriented anarchists. Do you feel that primitivists who were much more influential in the 1990s, are they part of this eco-fascist or eco-totalitarian tendency that you're locating, or do you think the primitivists are not even a threat to anyone anymore, like they were when Zerzan was much more, say, active in the Northwest?
Oh, geez. I mean, yeah, like that. I mean, to start with, like, just like a group of people who would, just like the name anarcho-primitivism is just like a reflection of like a lot's going wrong. Like, you know, not really questioning themselves, like, you know, how that's, you know, what that's going to say and what that's going to do to the peoples who have been historically labeled primitive and all the violence that goes along with it. I mean, like, I understand that it was an attempt to sort of, you know, do a detournement and, like, you know, to you know, say that what our civilization says is bad is actually good. I mean, like, you know, you can also look at it as sort of like in this like long, slow attempt by, you know, white people, like very much like starting from scratch, starting from like just this absolute ignorance about how the world works, and, you know, the history of everything that, you know, that gives us our privilege and our entitlement. Just trying, you know, very slow, starting from scratch, and obviously making a lot of really dumb errors. Trying to break with, you know, with like the value systems and with the very falsified history that underpins whiteness. But, you know, I mean, fortunately, like, there are a lot of much more relevant revolutionary currents that we can learn from. I don't think it's necessary to hold it up as a as an important reference right now. And, you know, there are, you know, very inspiring strains of anti-civilization anarchist thought that, you know, that aren't, you know, that don't identify as primitivist, that don't come from that. And so, you know, people who haven't questioned industrialism, people who, you know, the maximum transformation that they see is just worker control of everything that now exists, I think that's very problematic. And, you know, that definitely has, you know, a lot of colonial influence and white supremacist influence, and just capitalist conditioning in its worldview, even if, you know, they're not making as many unforced errors as calling themselves primitives. But yeah, I mean, I'm not terribly interested in different named tendencies. I think, you know, there's, you know, a lot more interesting conversations that happen between comrades who, rather than identify with an ideology, or identifying with their lived experiences, identifying with histories of struggle that inspire them, and you know, just recognizing that, you know, they're going to have different experiences and needs. So I mean, obviously, struggle in the workplace is vital and essential, but also, you know, we don't want workplaces. We don't want to be workers. We want to be able to meet our needs in a healthy way. So, you know, criticisms of workerism are also necessary, just as it's necessary to struggle in whatever spaces the economy affords us or forces us to participate in. And also criticizing civilization, criticizing ecocide are absolutely necessary. But it's impossible to do that well, and it's impossible to do that in a non-racist way if you're not linking it to colonialism and criticisms of colonialism. Yeah,
I can see that you've your own politics have evolved very, very much from the kind of debates between anarchists of the 1990s, which some of us were exposed to just as we were coming into the movement, right? I can see that you're following these movements have evolved much more, to the extent that primitivism is an art that term is hardly used anymore, and anti-civilization anarchism is the descendant of that more reactionary version of eco-politics that was going on 30 years ago, right?
So, Nisa, did you say that anti-civilization anarchism is the descendant of that reactionary politics?
Yes. I mean, it's fixed some of the problems too, is what I'm saying. I mean, I'm not saying it's followed in all the negative aspects of it either.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of different currents. Like Freddie Perlman, for example, doesn't have any overlap with the primitivist scene. Or the Indigenous Anarchist Federation, you also have a lot of critiques of what we're referring to as civilization, but they're definitely not coming from Zurzon. I know that in the U.S. a few years ago there were some big conflicts with some people from radical environmentalist or anti-civilization scene who were definitely getting much closer to far right positions, and I think that's going to happen anytime we don't recognize the centrality of colonialism and white supremacy to global capitalism, to the destruction of the environment.
Definitely. Your new book sounds really exciting in light of all of this, that you're moving beyond these old anarchist sectarian squabbles, and you're locating these new moments of struggle outside of the Eurocentrism and American centrism that anarchism has had for for several decades now. So it's really refreshing to hear your approaches to these things. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I hope it doesn't disappoint when it comes out.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for taking out time. I know you're busy.
Oh, no worries.
It's just a pleasure to learn from someone who's doing some really good work.
Well, this has been an excellent discussion on the Facing Autonomy podcast. We're gonna be posting this really soon. It was great to talk to you, Peter Gelderloos. Hopefully we can talk to you again in the future.
Gelderloos.
Please keep us aware of when you publish expansions of your Diagnostics of the Future essay, and when you publish your new book about ecology and anti-colonialism, because that does sound really fascinating, and we can't wait to read it over here.
Yeah,
definitely, we'll do.
Until that point, thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you so much for your amazing work that is obviously continuing in Spain. And have a really good rest of your winter. And please do not let COVID take you down, because your voice is so vital in these troubling times.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I hope you all stay healthy and fierce too.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Have an excellent day. Thank you so much.